Hello, and welcome to another episode of Untied Methodism, where we unravel the past to make sense of today. I am Dr. Ashley Bogan, your host and the General Secretary of the General Commission on Archives and History. And with me today are two wonderful guests. Reverend Stephanie Bennett is joining us again. Stephanie, you might be coming close to a five-timer's jacket pretty soon. For those of you who don't remember, she is the senior pastor of John Street United Methodist Church in Lower Manhattan and is the first woman appointed to serve that congregation. We also have Reverend Brian Milford joining us. Brian has many titles. He is president and publisher, CEO, and general secretary of the United Methodist Publishing House, which most folks probably know as Pokesbury. Thank you so much, Stephanie and Brian, for joining us.
Delighted to be here.
Good to be here.
All right, so we are taking a break in September from our 2026 emphasis looking at women and women's ordained ministry and ministry kind of before and after ordination to talk about a newspaper. And while that might sound kind of weird to most folks, this was actually like a pretty big deal of a newspaper. And on September 9th, 2026, we will be celebrating the 200th anniversary of this thing called the Christian Advocate. Stephanie, what the heck was the Christian Advocate and why should we celebrate 200 years of it?
Oh, I am so excited to have this conversation, particularly to get to have it with you and Brian, because I am so enthusiastic about marking the anniversary of the Christian Advocate. Because it was, I think, an essential feature of what we call the Methodist century. I think it's really hard to imagine what unfolded in the denomination across the 19th century without the Advocate. It's such a key piece of who we were becoming. And I think maybe it's a little forgotten because we have this kind of fossil of the Christian Advocate in what we call the Daily Christian Advocate that is published only while General Conference is meeting, and I guess just before. But the Christian Advocate was a weekly newspaper published by the Book Concern. As you said, it started in 1826, September 9th. That was a Saturday. And every Saturday afterwards, for decades and decades, a newspaper was put out from the Book Concern. So it began when the Book Concern was located in Lower Manhattan, where John Street is.
I'm going to interrupt you for a second. What is the Book Concern to?
The Book Concern is what we called originally, and I still call, the publishing house. So if this were 1826, we would be calling Brian the book steward, and we would call the organization he runs the Book Concern.
Thank you. Sorry for interrupting.
No. I forget that not everyone reads as much 19th century material as I do. So it was started in 1826, and within 2 years, this weekly newspaper that the Methodist denomination put out had more than 25,000 subscribers, and it rises to more than 30 in the 1830s. What's really significant about that is nobody else even came close to having as many subscribers as the Christian Advocate did. It has the largest subscription base of any periodical in the country and the largest readership of any periodical in the country. So if you have 30,000 subscribers, you almost certainly have somewhere between 125 and 150,000 readers. There's even complaints that come in to the paper about how postmasters were letting other people read it before I could come pick up my copy. So it is the most widely read periodical on this continent for several decades. And there was no secular publication that had a subscriber base of more than 5,000 people. If that gives you a sense of the scale we're talking about when we say more people heard from the Methodist denomination than any other organization on the continent. We were the most read, most heard voice mm-hmm. in the country.
And it's that way until the New York Times begins in like the 1840s, I believe. Is that right?
I think there's other religious papers in the 1840s that begin to encroach, I think. And then I think Beecher has a publication at some point. But even then, even when it's not the largest, it is still incredibly widely read and very important. And it is something that Methodists could point to and know that we were shaping our culture.
Mm-hmm. So a denominational newspaper. So when I think about like that, I'm imagining, you know, articles from bishops, stuff that talks about what's going on in the Methodist Church. So was it explicitly about Methodist news or did it do other things too?
Oh, it did so many other things. That is such a great question because there was some of that. I mean, the bishops were not going to miss an opportunity to put their thoughts out there to the denomination and anyone else who was, you know, could overhear. But it was not an inside baseball publication. It was intended, it was self-consciously Methodist in the sense that it was enthusiastic, it was evangelical, it was positive, it had all kinds of reports about revival and camp meetings, but it also had departments for domestic concerns and advice. It had science news and medical news and information. It had a department for children and youth. And one of my favorite departments to look at is the Department for Ministers, because it's got really great preaching advice and things like that. And it also had coverage almost every time of ministry for sailors, what was happening in ministry for sailors. And some of that was Methodist, but it was also, you know, across the evangelical spectrum. At this point, Methodists were part of an evangelical movement and were cooperating ecumenically. So it was a religious paper with the intent to be positive and religious, and with an intent to be useful and instructive is one of the ways it described itself. And it's really easy to see why people would want to come on board with what's happening because it was so infused with positivity and excitement. But it was also intended to be educational. Methodists really thought people should read and know things.
Imagine that. Right. Remind me, the rules, reading was second to preaching, is that right?
Yeah, Thomas Coke, when the book Concern is established, says that this is going to be a good thing because the most important thing Methodists do after preaching is reading.
Yeah, I might start putting that on the top of all of my syllabi. Brian, you can get a stamp for Coke's stories. Reading is second to preaching.
Good. So, Stephanie, you may not know this, but there is one of the original hand presses that printed the Christian Advocate in the lobby of the Westpath building outside of Chicago.
Oh, and, I guess I'm going to have to make a pilgrimage there.
And it has the a book plate of the 1839 edition of the Christian Advocate actually laying on the plate underneath the press. So that's one of the presses that we moved to Chicago when we moved out of our headquarters building. So
okay.
Fascinating to see. It's a beautiful old hand press. And hard to imagine folks printing a newspaper one page at a time on a hand press to distribute it across the country.
Well, and to do that 30,000 times.
Exactly.
Yeah. Very tired shoulder.
Yeah. So right, that is a labor of love for sure.
It is. So thinking about right, like just the sheer volume, right, and that it is done on a handful of presses, like what was the mechanism to get the newspapers out to people?
So preachers were the subscription agents.
Okay. That's a fancy word for salesman, I'm assuming.
Yeah. The distribution network and the pastoral network were the same people. So, I mean, I think that's fascinating to realize. Yeah. That there was a built-in infrastructure. Circuit riders also carried the paper in addition to post offices. They carried the paper along with everything else that they carried. And conferences supplied the structure. Readers supported publishing. Publishing profits supported worn-out preachers and their widows. Back to the Board of
the Pentecost. Original Westpath, worn-out right preachers.
Back to Westpath. So that the profits from the sale went back to support the pension program. So communication, I want to argue, created connection. It was building the infrastructure for the connection. Connection made ministry possible, and the advocate didn't report on Methodist connection. It helped it bring it into being.
Oh, wow.
I mean, think about that. The way that this tool and the infrastructure that surrounded it helped to build the what we now call the connection. It was a network. It was never just about the paper. It was about much, much more than that. It was never really a newspaper, the Christian Advocate. It was infrastructure. And that's really important for us to think about 200 years after the fact.
Mm-hmm. So it both kind of is a tangible object that can show us how the infrastructure of the connection works. And whenever I think about the Christian Advocate as well, I also think of it as kind of like that theological piece of the connection, right? It is where, if you wanted to know, like, what do Methodists believe about X, Y, or Z, or what's our point of view on what's going on in the world around us? It was kind of that singular unified voice that provided that theological connection as well.
It was, yeah, it attempted to be a singular.
Okay, say it more about it.
Wasn't necessarily a unified voice. I'll let Stephanie tell that story.
Well, and it did. It saw itself as the official denominational vehicle for exactly that, and as a voice that was intended to speak for and to the denomination about a host of issues. But as you might imagine, Methodists in the 1830s and 1840s didn't necessarily agree. I know that's shocking to us in the century that Methodists might have something to disagree about. And so at the time, the leading cause of debate and conflict and questions about what the church's stance would be was around the question of slavery. And the church as a whole was attempting to do a really great job of not taking a stand that would annoy or offend anyone. And so Nathan Banks, who was the editor of the Advocate in the 1830s, decided that the right course was to somehow manage to be both opposed to slavery, but at least, if not more, opposed to abolition. I think that is a mind-bending exercise that I really can't sort of figure out. But so because he was an institutionalist and he was concerned about there not being a big public ruckus over these things and concerned about not having the Southerners be offended by the paper or for it not to be, if they had covered abolitionism or promoted abolitionism, there are states where you couldn't have even mailed the newspaper. So he just refused to allow any coverage of abolition at all in the 1830s. I think it's 1835. He and Orange Scott are in the middle of a very, very bitter dispute in the New York and New England conferences. And so his solution was, we're just going to act like abolition doesn't exist. And so the paper, there's a real failure of nerve, a real poor decision on the part of not only Banks, but also the denomination, of course.
And I might add a failure of true Wesleyan identity.
Yes, yep. Absolutely.
So he not only refused to talk about abolition, as I understood it, he refused to talk about slavery, period, in the paper.
There seemed to be a few times where he would talk about slavery post 1836, where it was around colonialism, right? So that was the, I don't believe in slavery. I just want to, here's my solution for slavery is to. Yeah.
Like the American Colonial Society type?
Yes, exactly. And so that was, he sort of would continue to allow his foot to be dipped. So you're right in the sense that there was no writing in there that was pro-Southern opinion on slavery. They skirted the issue mostly, but I think he probably consoled himself by saying he was anti-slavery because he wanted to create colonies in Africa where people who had been enslaved here in this country could be freed and sent.
Yeah. So do you think this was all, you think it was all about him trying to hold the church together?
I do. I think it was about that, but it was also trying to hold the church together in a particular way. He did not, he wanted Methodists to be respectable, and he wanted us to be a denomination that was thought well of, and yeah. He could sense. I mean, this is the point we're already becoming well on our way to becoming the largest denomination in the country. And he does not want to lose that momentum. He does not want to lose that reputation. And he did not want a messy public fight, which he got anyway. But, right. And we all know the challenges of having a messy public fight in a denomination.
Yeah. The editorial caution failed on its own terms. I mean, he tried to keep it. I tried to hold the church together, and we split over slavery in 1844 anyway. So silence, I mean, I would argue silence is not neutrality. It was a choice with a bill attached, and the bill came due.
100%. I mean, it was a failure of nerve. It was a failure of leadership. It was the wrong choice for any number of reasons. And what's interesting is even before the Southerners walked out of General Conference, the abolitionists, Orange Scott, Luther Lee, they'd already taken off Leroy Sunderland. So even before that split, there was an earlier schism. And I think he had assumed that abolitionists wouldn't leave. He thought it was more likely that the Southerners would leave, but the abolitionists left first. And it's after 1840, when the abolitionists leave, that he does begin to gingerly step out and realize that could be harmful for the church if they had a reputation of having lost their abolitionist arm.
What do you mean by gingerly step out? So let me just fill in a couple gaps for our listeners. So the abolitionists who walked out was in 1842, and they formed the Wesleyan Connection in America, which would eventually become the Wesleyan Methodist Church, I think. It's kind of the predecessor to some of the holiness movements. And then in 1844 is when the General Conference kind of splits into the Methodist Episcopal Church and the Methodist Episcopal Church South. Stephanie, when the abolitionists leave, you said he Bangs began to step out. Is that...
Yeah, he publishes... finally, an anti-slavery document. And he's not vehement. It's nothing Luther Lee or Orange Scott would have been proud of him for. But he realizes he was attempting to self-correct too late.
So Stephanie, say a word or two about the Christian Recorder, the Star of Zion, and later the Southwestern Christian Advocate.
Well, you may be better, more prepared. You may be more informed about those than I am, because I'm so focused about New York. I know Zion's Herald is out of Boston and eventually is an abolitionist paper. And I know that the Book Concern began to have a Western Advocate. Is that accurate?
Yeah.
Supplement. And there were other regional advocates. I do know that.
Regional advocates formed to sort of address the expanding subscriptions that were happening. But these papers, as I understood it, formed because those voices were excluded from the Christian Advocate.
Okay. And
so there again, there was this this, it was an attempt to sort of address a more fundamental issue, and that was people wanted to know what was going on. They wanted to belong. They wanted to have a sense of a voice in this publication that was denied them by the editor. And so they found ways to do it. But again, there was this yearning to belong that didn't stop. And the new publications emerged, I think, as I understand it, and it's limited understanding, I'll admit. But these new publications arose because the official one couldn't hold the whole Methodist experience together, which I think is another lesson for us, right? Mm-hmm. A common voice for the whole, if it excludes people, is not a common voice for the whole.
Yeah. Well, and a common voice that's main priority is to not offend anyone is going to leave a lot on the table.
I just keep coming back to John Wesley's advice to the people called Methodist. And his second piece was, do not pretend that you cannot offend people. Right. Like he was like, you're going to offend people by just being Methodist.
Right. Yeah.
A common voice that excludes people was never genuine community in the first place.
Yeah, exactly. So these other publications are popping up to provide space for those other voices. And I'm assuming that's coming out of kind of the splits that start to happen predominantly in the early 1840s. Was there ever, after the 1844 split, was there ever like a Southern Christian advocate? Or did the Christian advocate still attempt to kind of hold a divided church together?
Well, there was certainly the Southern Publishing House. So the Publishing House split, and I don't know for sure about the
I think they started their own advocate.
I would imagine. I mean, they started everything else here.
Right. So. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so fascinating to think about. And while y'all were both speaking, you know, about a unified voice excluding others and these different forms, you know, the things that keep popping up in my mind are, okay, so the various blogs and social media accounts that, you know, now kind of work to let us know how United Methodists across the board are feeling or what they're fighting for isn't necessarily new. It's just now digital.
Yep.
It's not in print.
Yep. And I think one of the critical lessons here is that authentic Christian community requires both belonging and also the standing to be able to challenge and to correct and to be heard. Yeah. And that's really important for us to hear in our day. Mm-hmm. As we think about what next looks like.
So what happens to the Christian advocate? Like we alluded in the early bit that we now have kind of the daily Christian advocate during General Conference and the advanced daily Christian advocate leading up to General Conference. But those are really purely legislative and kind of a reporting out of General Conference. As far as I know, there's no Christian advocate that's still published.
There is not.
It ceases publication, I think, in 75 or 77.
I think there's some debate about when it actually ended, because there were some renaming and some other sort of efforts to sort of keep something going, but it didn't really happen. So in the 70s.
In the 70s. Okay.
And even before then, it had become more denominationally focused. So it did in the 1900s become more of an inside baseball kind of publication. Mm-hmm.
I think, I mean, the way that I've sort of come to understand is that what the infrastructure essentially broke down, the common publishing ecosystem fragmented and then dissolved. The advocate disappeared. It's gone. The United Methodist Reporter is gone after 166 years. More interpreter is gone. Mm-hmm. institutional purchasing declined, print economics collapsed, denominational identity weakened, and digital media like fragmented attention.
Yeah.
What didn't go away is the questions that the advocate tried to help answer, the Christian mm-hmm. advocate. And that's, you know, where is God in my life? Who are my people? How should we live together? And what can we accomplish together? Mm. That's critical. And I think that's the thing that we need to address in new and different ways. What disappeared was not the need, it was the infrastructure that organized people around the need.
Yeah. And Brian, would you say the infrastructure disappeared because was it that kind of the advocate got too big to be sustainable? Or was it that as you don't have circuit riders traveling as much and people localize, you don't have kind of like your salesman on a horseback, you know, getting new people, new subscribers? Or is it a competition thing of, you know, there all of a sudden, you know, there is the New York Times and there are all these other places where people could get news or opinions that they were no longer turning to the advocate for? Like it's, I think, you know, what would you say? I know there's never one singular cause, but.
Yeah, there's not one singular cause and it's, it is complicated, but I think the question is not what replaces the Christian advocate. It's what infrastructure helps this generation know God more deeply, mm-hmm. belong to one another more faithfully, and join with others in effective ministry. So if we limit it to who speaks for Methodism now, that question is pulls everything back toward a communication strategy. Mm. The richer idea is a connectional ecosystem. Mm. A healthy connection needs ways to learn and worship and interpret and disagree and remember and discover one another and share practice and mobilize resources and act together. That's what a healthy ecosystem, I think, needs to do. And
that's all it means.
a single voice newspaper mm-hmm. is not going to work in our world today. Yeah. The 19th century answer bundled most of those functions into four things: print, itinerancy, mm-hmm. Conferences, mm-hmm. and personal relationships. The Christian advocate was an answer to the early class meeting in their day.
It's interesting.
So that bundle of what happened in the 19th century is why the advocate felt more like a newspaper. It was carrying nine jobs at once. It was doing it all. We can't expect any single contemporary medium to unbundle and replace all of that. The real reason what replaces the advocate is the wrong question is nothing replaces it, because nothing today does nine things all at once. Mm-hmm. So what the future requires, I believe, is not a common publication, but common places of formation. So trusted resources, shared practices, theological conversation, worship, learning, and networks through which people discover what others are learning and doing. Mm-hmm. So, I've been racking my brain on what some examples might be. So one example might be the Common English Bible.
Okay.
It's perhaps the cleanest. Not perfect, but it's the cleanest. Thousands of congregations reading the same words on the same Sunday is a more durable form of connection than any newspaper ever was. Huh. Because it's a shared text rather than a shared opinion.
Hmm. Okay. That's interesting.
So you know, again, that's not a perfect example, but that's the one I sort of came up with as I was thinking about this. Curriculum, you know, if we had a curriculum that was shared by thousands of congregations, that would do that. A hymnal can, a Bible translation might, a digital formation platform could, a network connecting ministry leaders around common challenges can. So can books, video, gatherings, communities of practice, and resources that move naturally among them. But none of those is a voice. All of them are a connection. Yeah. Not one voice, not a single medium, an ecosystem in which learning practices and resources move across the connection.
Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that I've been curious kind of to think through, Brian and Stephanie, you know, it's so Brian, as you were kind of like naming all these different things, the snarky thing that pops into my head is, isn't there an app for that? Like, or, you know, like why? I know that I don't know this 100% sure, but I will say 90% sure, probably most bishops or annual conferences have their own podcast. I think most general agencies probably have their own podcast, right? Like we seem to be doing that work of getting different voices out there that speak through that United Methodist lens to different problems of our day. And we're doing it within pieces of the connectional system, but not in a way that is actually connectional.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. So like, yeah, what would it look like to have, I mean, nobody listens to the radio anymore, but like a United Methodist radio station, like or a space that would conglomerate all of these different podcasts and blogs. You know, United Methodist Insight was kind of the closest thing that brought together all of the blogs.
Yep.
And it's, you know, in transition right now.
I think that's a really interesting question, given that how like social media, which had some promise for some of these sorts of things, has kind of collapsed on itself. So I think that's fascinating, actually, that there might have been a time when something like a Facebook could have been a place we all went and found a plethora of ideas and opinions and thinking around. But right now you have to come, you know, fight with the algorithm to even see your pictures of your kids' mm-hmm. friends, much less denominational stuff.
Yeah. So you guys, we've landed on the conundrum that drives the publisher of the United Methodist Church absolutely crazy.
I'm so glad we can drive you crazy.
We are so much better at producing resources than we are at building relationships.
Mm-hmm. That'll preach.
And those relationships are what carries the resources. That's mm-hmm. what worked for the Christian Advocate. It was the relationships that carried that paper around. It was the post office guy who let other people read it. So it's why there were 30,000 subscribers, but the estimates I've read say 150,000 readers.
Yeah.
Which is just, I mean, mind-boggling.
Yeah.
The 19th century network had both the resources and the relationships.
Yeah.
We mostly have the first, and I don't think we have figured out the second.
Yeah. Well, and I do think there's a third, which is there was this attitude. I mean, at least early on, there is very much a "what hath God wrought" vibe, right, to the whole thing, where there is an expectation that God is at work. They're in the middle of the Second Great Awakening. And things are happening, and they are convinced that God is at the center of it.
Something's happening. Yep.
And they are filled with expectation. Now, who is not going to want to be a part of that? It was self-consciously Methodist, but it was public facing. So it was not only about how do we build connections with each other, it was about how do we serve the world. What can we bring? What can we offer? And there was a sense that what we could offer was remarkable and life altering and would make a difference. And it's infused early on with that. And I don't know where that shows up in a public facing way where we are literally attempting and believing that we're reaching more readers than anyone else on the continent.
Yeah. Well, and think about our current situation. We lost nearly a quarter of our congregations over the last few years. I don't know yet what connection means for a church that just went through that. Mm-hmm. And I'm frankly pretty suspicious of anybody who does.
Right.
Well, so this isn't my time to pitch you a book on connection.
I think too, the ecosystem requires people to, like I said, fight the algorithm and fight all the other noise to be heard. And so you have people who have to do a lot to draw attention to themselves if their voice is going to be heard, if their book is going to be read. And mm-hmm. that ends up being people raising their hand for themselves and not raising our hands together to point to what hath God wrought.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep. I think that's exactly right, Stephanie. They weren't trying to build an institution that would last 200 years. They were trying to answer the question, where is God in my life this week?
And where is God?
What hath God wrought?
Where is God in my town?
Yeah.
And where is God in your community?
Yep.
Because they're always asking for people, send us what's happening. Send us word of your revivals and your camp meetings. And people are writing in and saying, you would not believe what's happening here. I was reading and I found one for this revival that was unfolding at the eastern end of Long Island. And so I sent the superintendent out there. I was like, I know some of these churches still exist. And it was just filled with, you can't believe what God is doing here.
Right. Again, they weren't trying to build an institution that would last 200 years. And it, you know, frankly, it feels to me as one of the bureaucrats that we're way overly focused on the institution.
Mm-hmm. And survival of it.
And survival of the institution. Where's God at work in my life? And let's help people identify that.
They also truly, truly believed that preaching, class meetings, and reading were incredibly important and impactful.
Absolutely. Yep. And curiosity was a huge part of their orientation. Yeah. Again, I think the advocate didn't report on the connection. It helped create it.
Yeah, that's going to stick with me for a little bit. I really like that. And you may be getting a book proposal for me. I know. But, you know, like right now, you know, we talked, you both have talked about, you know, the relationships, and that's kind of the piece that we're missing. And I agree that we as the United Methodist Church, we are so focused, especially in this post-disaffiliation space, on institutional survival. And we have this scarcity mindset that limits our ability to imagine anything beyond getting us through the next year or the next general conference.
Right.
And this relationship piece, like I think some of our listeners may push back a little bit and say, well, I have good relationships with people who come to my church on Sunday or who I sit next to in the pews. Or like, you know, if they're a pastor listening, you know, like hopefully they have a great relationship with their DS or their bishop. Where I think that the breakdown is happening is that our relationships have gotten to be so localized.
Yes.
And so it's that almost reteaching people that being connectional, yes, it's about relationships, but it's about relationships beyond people that you see on a day-to-day or a month-to-month basis. It's about people that you would never meet in your life. And what is your relationship with them? How is God working in your life in a similar way that God's working their lives and working in different ways? And kind of appreciating and uplifting that. And that's the piece where We live in a very kind of individualized society, that it's mm-hmm. so hard to teach people to give a crud about anything that doesn't directly affect them. Mm-hmm. So teaching them to, or trying to rebuild this connectional relationship with people that someone's never going to meet. It's not impossible, but I do think that that's an interesting spot for me in this.
Yeah.
I think you're right. And I think we are inundated with the illusion of connection, right? I mean, Methodist connection is not arguing with people in a Methodist group on Facebook. So we have these opportunities for a proxy for connection mm-hmm. that do not actually serve.
Interesting. So there are ways, there are like pseudo connections or ways that people think, oh, I am being connectional, right? Like I'm having this discussion, but that might be.
Maybe it's connection adjacent.
Yeah, that's interesting.
But I think we have a lot of proxies. And some of that, though, is just that I think people are afraid, lonely, disconnected, and trying to survive. Mm. And they, some of them might realize that a church might fix that, but they come in so often to our doors afraid that maybe maybe sitting next to someone in a pew really sometimes also just ends up being another proxy. Mm. If you don't have the opportunity, this is why class meetings really mattered, right? Mm-hmm. If you don't have the opportunity to sit someone face to face.
Yeah.
And ask how it is with your soul. If you just sit that next to them. Or maybe three pews over, right? Because we've got, I don't know about y'all, but there's often plenty of room between folks in the pews.
Yeah. In my experience, the Holy Spirit always seems to find ways to have this sort of connection thing happen. And the question is, am I open to it? Being perceptive of it. Am I recognizing that this person that I don't know is somebody that God has placed in my path for a reason? And I just need to be open to what that reason might be, because you never know where it's going to happen. And I do think we can get insular in our congregations and so inwardly focused that we lose sight of the fact that there's a way bigger world out there and that God is at work in that world if we would just engage it. So,
amen. Well, any kind of last, I love kind of ending the conversation with what you just said, Brian, because I think that was perfect, but I don't want y'all to miss the opportunity if you had something you really wanted to say and haven't had a chance to say it yet.
This has been great. I mean, I could go on for hours, and I think maybe podcast doesn't last that long. So right. I'm engaged.
I knew I was going to have a good time, but this has been a very rich, fertile conversation.
And thank you both. I agree. We could do this for hours, kind of theorizing, communication and relationship and connection, but. This is a great kind of teaser. We'll do a second episode or something on this next year. This has been a great teaser for our listeners to kind of be introduced to the Christian Advocate and to learn a little bit more about what it means to truly be in connection with one another. So thank you both for taking time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
And to our listeners, we will see you all next time. Thanks for listening.